good afternoon. So, last time we talked a bit about the kind of last category of exceptions we introduced, which was exceptions for AL. And this is because it's, you know, once you tell it, say, like, well, what do we mean by saying there's exceptions for AL? And exceptions are a way of running the OS, so when we say about there are exceptions for AL, this is when we have an external device that needs to notify the operating system that it needs handling. And this can happen often when we have some program running that isn't actually using that device right now, but you know, the device still needs attention, and we need to run the OS to give the device that attention. And because this is a big point of confusion, it's worth talking about how this interacts with system calls for I.O., like what's going on there. And kind of our typical pattern is that, well, when your program wants to talk to a device, it makes a system call, and sometimes we can do all the work we need to do while handling that system call, that we can just set up, you know, our output or retrieve some input immediately from that system call. But often, the actual output or input can't be done at that time. In that case, the operating system isn't just going to, you know, sit there. It's going to do something else while waiting for the device to be ready to give more input or ready to get more output. And it's going to have the device notify it with this exception mechanism, you know, to indicate that it's ready for reading and writing. And also, if we like get input before we request it, the device isn't just going to be able to keep that forever. It needs the OS to like handle, oh, you got data from the network. I pressed some keys before you read them. We still need the operating system to retrieve that data. The device is going to notify it even if there hasn't yet been a request to read it because, well, you know, the device doesn't know that and the operating system still needs to track that information. So we use these I/O exceptions to have the device notify the OS that something happened, but when the program wants to make a request of the device, it still makes a system call, and sometimes, you know, maybe that system call, you know, doesn't need any other exceptions to actually do its work, but sometimes, you know, we're going to have this multi-step process where the OS typically goes off and does something else rather than leaving our processor sitting there staring at the device waiting for it to be ready to do something. So after we talked about sort of our I/O exceptions, we talked about this idea of signals and signal handlers. We mentioned that signals were kind of like a version of exceptions for our programs, if we think of exceptions as something for the operating system. So we can register a handler in our programs to wait for some event. And there's a big variety of events that we could potentially wait for. We saw the example of, you know, an explicit request from another program, a sort of bad memory access or something like that, or some interesting input like control C. All these could trigger a signal, and when we have a handler registered, the OS will call that handler as part of our process. So our process will stop doing whatever it's doing and start running our signal handler as if in a function call. This is kind of like how, if we think of how exceptions work with the OS, the processor stops running whatever it was running and starts running that OS's handler function. And when we were talking about how signals work, we mentioned that one issue with signals is that because they interrupt our process at some time potentially determined by some external event, they can interrupt our process at some weird times. And we're going to continue looking at that issue as our first topic for today. So before I do that, questions about things we covered last time? Seeing any. So one logistical thing. So that's some anonymous feedback expressing concern that some people seem not to understand how the collaboration policy applies to the quizzes. Quizzes are individual, please. So this means, for example, if you want to compare your quiz answers, wait till after the deadline. So going back to our signal delivery can occur at word times. We had this example here where we had a call to malloc and our signal handler that runs printf. And a way you might implement malloc, this is not the only way you might see malloc implemented, is that you might have a pointer, which in this thing is called next to return, that points to the memory available, and when someone asks to allocate some amount of memory, you'll select a portion of that and return that, and then advance the pointer to point to the end of that region. This is not the only way you can implement malloc, but this is a common idea. And to make this work, we kind of have these two steps. We figure out where the chunk of memory we're returning is, and we advance this pointer, this global state that's tracking, you know, where the next one will be for the next call to malloc. And if we think of how this interacts with signals, we have this situation that, well, signals could happen anywhere, in the sense that the handler could be run at any time. If it's like a control C, I can potentially press control C such that it gets handled right between when we do these two updates. Right between when we figure out what we're returning and finish the update to the next thing to return. And what might happen is potentially our signal handler might end up calling malloc. And often it will do it very indirectly. So for example, printf does some pretty complicated things. So it might allocate memory to do its work. In this case, maybe it's not so obvious, but like if you think of the general case of printf, like percent, you know, percent %s, percent %d stuff, like there's cases where you might imagine we might want memory allocated. So in this case, if we think of our overall scenario, we have our foo function, which is calling malloc, and we're just about to do our next to return operation, plus equals operation, but we haven't gotten there yet. So in foo, we have our original next to return pointer to our memory, and we've decided that we are returning this chunk of memory to foo. And then when printf calls malloc, well, it's going to use the current value of the next to return function pointer, which doesn't have a complete update because we haven't actually finished the first malloc yet. And it's going to return an overlapping region of memory. And then it's going to advance the next to return pointer based on that. Then the signal handler is going to finish. We're going to go back and finish up foo's call to malloc. And it's going to add on to the original next to return. So we've ended up allocating the same memory twice and also wasting a bit of memory for nothing. this is going to manifest in a kind of a really non-intuitive way that, you know, maybe, you know, we're going to have printf behave weirdly or foo behave weirdly based on them both using the same memory, or maybe we won't even notice anything until after one of them tries to free this memory. And then malloc gets confused about what memory is actually allocated or free. So this is a really ugly situation that is like basically impossible to debug that we would like to avoid. And this is kind of just a consequence of that, well, it's really hard to write functions where I can say at any point I'm going to call your function again if the function has any sort of state. And malloc has state, needs to keep track of all the memory. It's just really hard to write a function that works correctly when you call it within itself. It's not impossible, but it's a lot of extra work. And it's extra work that the implementers of the standard library, for the most part, have not done. And in particular, you know, since we want signal handlers to be possibly useful, there is a guarantee. And POSIX, which is a standard that Linux, among other things, follows, defines a list of what they call async signal safe functions. If you go log into Portal and type man signal-safety, you can get a list of what these are. And these are required to work correctly no matter what they interact for. So for these, they've done the extra effort to make them work, even if they're called within themselves. Typically, the way that happens is that most of these correspond to a single system call, and since the OS implements both system calls and signal handlers, the kernel, I should say, the kernel knows how not to get confused when they're called happening within each other, since it knows, it chooses when signal handlers run, and it can take into account that there's a system call going on. But some of them might be, use some other techniques. We'll look at one idea later of blocking signals. That would be another possible way to do this. But however they're done, these are the functions where the implementers of the standard libraries have said, we've gone to the extra effort to make sure these will behave correctly if they're called within each other. Pretty much everything else, you have to worry about that thing like something like malloc happening or some other global state that potentially means you'll have this corner case. Well, you have this impossible to debug error that makes things just not work. And this list, it's not short, but it doesn't include a lot of functions you might want to use. So for example, it includes the function write and the function underscore exit, which is why some of the examples we had last time used write and underscore exit in single handlers instead of something you might find more straightforward. It's because they have this guarantee. But some other functions you might find common don't. So for example, printf does not. The normal exit does not. Malloc does not. Yes.
If the other exit and the normal exit basically do the same thing, why
would you choose? So the question is, what's the difference between underscore exit and exit? So exit does things like flushes all open files and runs add exit handler, so you can call add exit to make a function run add exit. Underscore exit does not do that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, are there any functions which are impossible to make signal safe? So there's kind of a brute force strategy we could use, which is that we can block signals during a function. We'll talk about what blocking exactly means, but basically we can delay the signal handler from running, and that will make the function signal safe, you know, maybe not in a very exciting way, but, you know, so there is an option, but that's not very efficient and also might kind of
get in the way of why you have a signal handler in the first place. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so I mentioned this idea of blocking signals. So let's talk about what that means. So one thing we might want to do, because we know signals handlers running at random points in time are not so useful, is that we want to have the ability to stop them from running at specific times. And there's an interface for doing what's called blocking a signal. This is sometimes also called masking a signal, because the list of block signals is called the signal mask. So the list of blocked signals equals the signal mask. And this was the thing we were setting to an empty set for signal handlers, because we don't want additional signals blocked in a signal handler normal. But we can block specific signals, and when a signal is blocked, the signal handler doesn't run. But that doesn't mean the signal is just ignored. That instead of acting on the signal by running a signal handler or like killing the process, terminating the process, the signal becomes what's called pending. And if we ever unblock a signal, the pending signal will be delivered, meaning it will be acted on running a signal handler or, you know, terminating the process or similar. So what we can do is, you know, when we're doing something where we don't want the signal handler to run, we can block a signal. And when the signal is received by our process, rather than the signal handler running and potentially messing things up, the OS just records, hey, there's a pending signal. And later on, if we ever unblock the signal handler gets to run at that time. Questions on blocking a signal? Yes?
I know we talked about last class that you, there's some signals that you can't make a signal handler for. Are there any signals that you can't block?
Question, are there any signals that you can't block? So yes, the same signals you can't make a signal handler for, blocking them doesn't do anything. Other questions? Okay, so one thing this lets us do is this gives us a way to make any function async signal safe, but maybe gets, you know, maybe not in a satisfying way because, you know, we aren't handling the signal at a time we want to. And we can kind of apply this to handle signals at control times only. And a very common strategy for doing this is not to just say, try to identify dangerous functions and block signals during them, but to have this notion that you'll have signals usually be blocked, and you'll only unblock them at specific times. Or you can even not have a signal handler, and there are API calls to directly manipulate the list of pending signals. And so this gives us some strategies for basically handling signals without an actual signal handler. So maybe the conceptually simplest way is that we can block the signal when we start, and we can decide there are specific points in our program where we want to handle signals, and we can call a function that temporarily unblocks the signal at that point in time. So one example of such a function is sigsuspend, which basically unblocks a signal and waits until a handler runs, and then returns and reblocks the signal. Or pselect, which is used to wait for I/O, but while it's waiting for import or output, it also unblocks some signals temporarily, so your signal handlers run at that time. But if you leave the signals blocked at other times, you know it won't run like in the middle of a call to malloc. And the other option, as I mentioned, is that we can just leave the signal blocked forever, but still handle it because we can check what signals are pending.
And probably the most sort of common way of doing this is with something like SIGWAIT. So what SIGWAIT does is it waits for a signal to be marked as pending, and when it's marked as pending, it returns. If the signal's already pending, it just returns immediately. And we can use these sorts of strategies just instead of having an actual signal handler. And I would argue that if you can get away with it, this is the sort of thing you should be doing, because it is way easier to reason about what can happen in this case than with signal handlers, which run at any time. So I'll give like a specific example of what the code for using SIGWAIT looks like. And with SIGWAIT, kind of like we have two sort of timelines. You know, in both cases, we block the signal before we use SIGWAIT. And what could happen is that the signal's received, and then sometime later, we call SIGWAIT to check for that signal. In that case, SIGWAIT will make the signal not be pending anymore. And that means that, you know, there will be never any time where the OS tries to run the signal handler or terminate the process from the signal, because it was never pending and unblocked. It was either blocked and not pending, blocked and pending, you know, never pending and unblocked, because we make it not pending with SIGWAIT. Another thing which might happen is we call SIGWAIT before we receive the signal. In that case, SIGWAIT waits for it to become pending, and immediately when it becomes pending, SIGWAIT stops it from being pending and just tells you, hey, we got that signal. And an example of code, you know, showing what the SIGWAIT API looks like and also the blocking signal API looks like is here. So here we create a set listing just the SIGINT signal, and we say block that signal in this current process. So after we call this, whenever SIGINT is sent to our process, it's recorded by the OS and marked as pending, but not acted on. Then we output waiting for SIGINT and call SIGWAIT. And SIGWAIT, when it finds a signal is pending, will tell us which signal it found as the value of num. And we can use that to figure out, oh, yes, we got a SIGINT. Yes? Question, what's the signal being blocked and pending? So a signal that's blocked just means that if we receive the signal, it won't be acted on and will become pending. So a signal that's pending is one we received but hasn't been acted on. And without blocking, usually a pending signal, when the OS notices it, will just run our signal handler or terminate our program. And what's going on with SIGWAIT is SIGWAIT gives us a way of making a signal that's pending not be pending anymore without having it be unblocked at any time. And therefore also without having any handlers run for it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is our typical pattern. So in this case, we could have, so at any time after this signal being blocked, we could have our control C happen at any time here. And whenever it happens, it will make the signal be pending. And after that, SIGWAIT can return and tell us, yes, we got a signal. And there's no actual running of a signal handler here, and no abnormal termination of our process from control C, as long as control C doesn't happen until after we call sigprocmask. Questions? Our signal handling without using SIGWAIT. So this type of strategy using SIGWAIT or
something else that mostly blocks signals. Or alternately, I'm not going to show this how to do it because we haven't talked about multi-threading, but another strategy is to have a separate thread handle signals. That's what I would recommend instead of using normal signal handlers if you actually need to handle signals in like a real program, because it just dodges the signal safety issue. Now, this is not what we're going to have you do in the lab. In the lab, we're going to use traditional signal handlers because we want you to use them. And we have a lab next week that's going to use signals. So you're going to make a local inter-process chat program. And we're going to give you code to set up shared memory between two different processes running on the same machine, meaning that you'll have basically two arrays that are shared between the two programs, literally access the same bytes of memory. So this is a convenient way to send messages from one program to another, but it's not a convenient way to notify one program that a message is available. So we're going to use signals to do that operation. We're going to send a signal from one process to another to indicate there's a message available in that shared memory. We're going to use signals to do that and have a signal handler that handles receiving the message from that shared memory region. That's going to be the lab next week. Questions? Not. Okay, so that's sort of our conclusion of talking about signals. But in talking about signals, you know, we've kind of talked about, multiple processes interacting with each other. And we kind of just assume we start separate programs and we somehow know PIDs. We're going to actually talk about what's the interface look like for starting and manipulating processes. And we're going to look at kind of what we need to do to do something like what the shell does. When you type ls minus l, that runs a program that lists a directory and waits for it to finish and then prompts you for a next command. Talk about what is the interface used to do that look like, you know, and how does that work? And we've already alluded to part of this when we talked about process IDs, that we said we have this way of sending a signal to a specific process and we needed to identify the process, and we said, well, we're going to do that with a number. And if you want to get your current process's number, you can call getPID to get your current process's ID for things like that kill library call. But something we haven't talked about is how we create programs, how we wait for programs, and so on. And that's what our next topic is going to be. And something you might notice is weird here is that I separated creating a process from running a program. And that seems like a weird choice. Like, isn't creating a process and running a program the same thing? Well, not in the traditional Unix API. So we're going to have an operation to create a process that's going to create a new process, but it's not going to be running a new program. It's going to be running the same program that we started with. We're going to have a separate operation that doesn't create a new process, but changes what program the current process is running. So we'll go through each of these, and then we'll go through, well, how do we combine these in a useful way to do something like what our shell does to run programs, and like what's going on. So I'll start with our process creation operation, which is called fork. And fork is probably the most confusing function we will talk about in this class. And for being the most confusing function, it has a very simple prototype. It takes no arguments and returns a PID. What makes it confusing is that it copies the current process. So this means that when it's done, there are two copies of the current process. And part of the process is like what our program counter is. So both of those copies are in the middle of a call to fork, meaning it returns twice. Once in the old process, and once in the new process. And to help us out with writing code that uses fork, fork uses a different return value in the copy versus the original. So in the original, which we will call the parent, it returns the PID of the new process. And we actually kind of really need this because it's really hard to figure out what that PID is if it didn't return it to us. And in the child process, to let us know that we're in the child process, the new one, it will return zero. In the child process, if I want to get the PID of the new process, I can just call get PID, but that doesn't really work in the parent to get the new PID. And this really is a copy of the process, and it's a deep copy. So we're going to duplicate all the memory. So to kind of give a picture of what's going on, let's say in our kernel, we're tracking this information about the process. We have our registers. We have our memory mapping that we'll learn is stored in page tables. That's stored somewhere in memory. We have our list of open files and a whole bunch of other information, some of which we've talked about, some of which we haven't, like user IDs and so on. The calling fork is going to copy that whole chunk of process info, and it's a deep copy, so it's also going to copy all the memory and make a new copy of the memory. The mapping is going to come from the same virtual addresses, but go to new real addresses because we have new memory for the new copy process. And I mentioned that to help us figure out which process we're in when fork returns, it's going to return differently in the two processes. So we're going to edit our return value to be different depending whether we're the original or the copy. Yeah? What would happen if I call fork in a loop, in an infinite loop? Then you're going to attempt to keep creating processes, which, you know, is going to run out of memory, and fork will start failing, and probably your system is not great at handling resource exhaustion. Don't do that. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at kind of a simple example of how fork works. So here I have a call to fork. So in this, to like make it clear what's going on in our output, I get the PID that we have originally and print it out. Then I call fork, and I mentioned that fork, here we have these return value tells us, so it returns the child PID if in parent, and zero if in child, child being the new process. So if we have a positive return value, that means we're in the parent process. And in this case, I call get PID again, and print out, you know, my PID and parent of and the child PID. If I'm in the child, it returns zero. So I get my PID, print that out, and then I'm in the child. And I have this else. You might say, how can that else happen? So fork has another possible return value, which is minus one. This is minus one converted to a PID T. If there's an error.
And why would fork fail? For example, if we're out of memory or you've reached some other sort of limitation. And so an example of how this might run is we might get the output here of, we'll have first our parent might print out its PID. Well, let's say this example is 100. Then we fork and we have the parent and child running simultaneously. So I'm like showing this execution as these squiggly lines indicate a thread that runs a sequence of instructions. And when I have these two threads side by side, we don't actually know the order they'll end up running in, because that's up to how the OS switches between them. Or maybe they even actually run simultaneously and at different speeds if we have multiple cores. So in this example, I'm saying that the parent process happens to run its print first, and then our child process happens to run. We could have had it also happen the other way around. So we could also have had these swapped, in which case, these just happen in the other order, and we don't know actually what will happen because it's up to sort of when the OS gets a chance to run each of the two processes. Once we've created the new process, it's something that the OS can run on a processor, and it's going to do so at some point, and we don't know how soon. And our parent process, which was already running, well, the OS could switch away from that to something else at any time, so we don't know if it gets to run first either, based on it having been running before fork. That doesn't tell us anything either. Yeah. So the question is, how are the PIDs generated? So in this example, I've just arbitrarily said our parent PID is 100 and our child PID is 432. So I guess there's two strategies that systems typically use for PIDs. So one is just to allocate them sequentially for all processes. The other I've seen is to generate a random PID. So the first scheme, there's a relationship, but maybe not a particularly useful. So in this example, our parent PID was 100. So we can identify that this is output from the parent, and it got the correct PID of the child, and the child PID is 432. And I showed you one of the possible outputs. We have the one where it's flipped. It's also possible because we don't know, once we have two processes, we don't know which will run faster than the other. Other questions on our example with fork? Okay, so let's do an exercise here. So let's say our parent process has PID 99 and our child has PID 100. Give me two possible outputs of this program. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should happen. A minute or two. Two possible outputs. Who'd like some more time? Any volunteers to give me one possible output? Anyone? Yeah. Okay, so you're giving me the output of one process. Could you tell me the output of both of the processes together? Is that from the beginning or in child? Okay. Child 100. Okay. And then done. Okay. So one point that is part of a deliberate thing I've done in this exercise, two dones, yes, is that done is printed twice. So something a lot of people want to happen, because we have this common pattern with fork, where we fork, and then we have an if statement to have a segment of code that runs in the parent and the child, a lot of people want to say, oh, well, this is the child code, so that's what runs in the child. But remember, what's happening is that fork is just returning, and we're going into that if statement because of the return value. What happens after we run an if statement? We run the next line of code. So both from here, we still go to the done line. There's nothing that stops us from doing that in either process. And that means that done, as long as fork is successful, will get printed out twice. Okay. So questions on that? Yeah. So the question, what's a practical use case for using fork? So in the traditional Unix environment, fork was the only way to create a new process. So anything that involves creating a new process had to have fork involved. So that includes, like, if you want to implement a shell and run commands and new processes, you had to use fork. Does that answer your question? So, and obviously, we haven't talked about all the steps to, like, run a different program yet. That's going to be a later topic. Other questions? Okay, so can someone volunteer a second possible output? Yeah. Okay. In child. Done. Okay, anyone with a third? Preferably someone who hasn't gone yet. But yeah. Okay. And yeah, I'll use a third color. In child, done. Child 100. Yeah, so those are three possible outputs, and there's some more. And the reason we have multiple possible outputs is that once these are running, they can run kind of in arbitrary order. For reasoning about what the outputs are, one thing I sometimes like to do is draw this style of diagram. So we have our fork call. And then if we think about what's happening, we have these two tasks running in parallel. And I can go down each of the two threads and, at any relative speed and sort of any interleaving of them. So I can select something from either of these as long as I'm going further down the last thing I selected until I'm done. And all of these in practice, are possible. It just depends on when does the operating system decide to switch to other programs. And there's a lot of factors that can influence that, especially if we have like other programs running on the system or multiple cores. So questions about our possible outputs with fork here? Okay, so one thing I'd like to have be clear is how fork interacts with variables and data. So here's a second exercise. So same thing, figure out which of the outputs I give are possible. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what the answer should be. And the thing to remember here is I told you that fork copies the current process, and that's a deep copy. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer should be that, sorry, multiple possible outputs. So who thinks A is a possibility? Okay, B, C, D, E,
F, okay, so this is less split than it was this morning, which means I guess I emphasize things differently, which is good, because the correct answer is A and D. And I have this example because this is a very common point of confusion I've seen, is that people really want things to be shared between our two processes after fork. That is not going to happen unless you try to make it happen. And in particular, if we go back to our diagram here, if we think of where are these variables, we have our global variable x. That's somewhere in this memory here. So it got copied. So we now have a completely independent global variable. Now, because we're using address translation, we have a mapping from our program addresses to our real addresses. It has the same memory address, but that means a different thing in the new process. We think of our variable y. That was a local variable. There's kind of two places that could be. One is it could be one of the registers. Another is that it could be on the stack that's also in memory, and because we made a copy and we have a different mapping, even if it has the same memory address, that's different memory for the two processes, because we have a different address mapping for the two processes. So that gives us that in our parent process, we're going to, we're going to get xy equal to first 0, 0. Then we're going to run x plus equals 3, get 3, 0, then 3, 4. And we're going to print that. In our child process, we're going to have x and y be 0, 0. Then we're going to add 1 to x and 2 to y, and then we're going to print that. And I didn't need to consider what the other process was doing in making this timeline, because it doesn't matter, they're independent copies of x and y. Some questions? Oh, yes. Question, if I want to have a variable that both processes change, would you need to use a pointer? So using a pointer won't really help, because remember, we have a copy of the memory mapping, so what an address is in the two processes is now different. So using a pointer is not the distinction that's going to help us. If you want to set up the processes to actually share memory, you can do that. And the way you do that is similar to the code we supply for the signals lab. In the signals lab, we do it with two processes that aren't started in a related way, like they aren't fork for each other, but the same idea will work for processes that are related via fork. And could actually be done before the fork, and will work because it's special, it's a different type of memory allocation than a normal one. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes.
Where would the child process resume execution after? Is it after the fork call?
Question, where does the child process resume execution? It resumes it in the middle of the fork call. So when we copy the process, something that's part of these registers is the PC is going to be middle of fork. And that's true in both of these cases. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
If the fork happened, you called fork in the middle, so maybe after the first if statement, then would it just take the values of x and y at that particular time instead of it being zero already?
Question, if I called fork later, would it take the values of x and y at that particular time? Yes. Okay. Anything else? Okay, so we've gone through creating a new process, but so far our process continues to run the same program, which usually isn't what we're thinking about doing when we're thinking of starting a process. Usually we're thinking about running a different program. And the way we run a different program is with a bunch of library calls which all start with exec. So I wrote exec star. There's a bunch of different library calls which start with exec and have some other letters after them, which just differ in how they take their arguments. They do basically the same thing, just take their arguments in a different way. I'll show the specific example of exec v, but note there's others you can look up which just take their arguments differently. In the case of exec v, our first argument is the path to the program we want to run, so the executable file we want to run. And the second argument is the value of argv that we want to end up being passed into the main of that program. And since I'm not passing an argc here, execv figures out how big that argv is based on having a null pointer after the last argument. So to give an example of this, I'm going to show an example of doing roughly what the shell will do if you type ls minus l. So if you type ls minus l, it's going to run the ls program. Typically on Linux, that would be located in /bin/ls. So that's the executable file. So we're going to pass that to execv as the thing to run it. We're going to set argv for ls to the array containing the string ls, the string minus l, and we'll have a null terminator to let exec v how many arguments there are. So why is ls the first argument? So if we think of how main is typically called, the argv passed to main, conventionally argv0 is the sort of name of the program used on the command line. And argv1 and afterwards are the actual arguments. That's the convention programs expect on Unix, so that's how I'm writing ls. So I'm setting its argv to follow that rule. And as is usually the case with execv and other exec calls, I'm combining this with fork. Why am I combining this with fork? Because normally, exec never returns. So if I want to do something after running ls, I need to spawn in a new process. So I have this code after exec, but this only runs if exec fails. If exec works, I never go back to the original process that called exec. That process is now running, in this case, ls, and we've lost the information needed to go back. So we'll often see this combined with fork, so I can have a new process run ls, and my existing process can continue to run whatever I was running. If we're thinking of your command line, it can prompt for the next command later, because it's still running, to be able to do that. If we just exec without forking, it wouldn't be running, couldn't still do that. And so I'm mentioning that this replaces the current process and doesn't return. So let's talk about how that looks like with our picture of our OS data structures for managing a process. So we have our, our memory mapping here. This is the memory mapping, which we'll learn is also the page tables.
and it's running our process, and we call exec. So what we're going to do is we're going to set up the memory for the newly loaded program. So we're going to load its code from disk. We're going to set up a new stack, a new heap, everything we need to start the program. And we're going to adjust our memory map to point to that new stuff. Then we have to set up the arguments for main to be called. So we're going to copy that over to the newly allocated memory. And we're also going to reset all the registers to their starting values for a program starting from the beginning. So notice that we're doing all of this with the process control block, which used to be running our old program. So we're just reusing that same process information that the OS tracks, but running a different program in it. And I am going to change the registers and the memory mapping. I'm going to leave a bunch of other things unchanged. So for example, the files that are open, the current directory we're in, all that, we're not going to reset. It's just going to stay the same. So once I've set this up, I can get rid of the memory for the old process. We don't need it anymore because we're never going back to it. And we'll just keep running this new process. So not new process. We'll keep running this new program, but in the same sort of process we had before. Same PID, but it's a new program. I should be careful about how I'm using these words. So, new program, same process. So questions on what exec is doing? Okay. So, as you've seen here, our typical usage of exec is combined with fork. And this kind of matches the intuition of probably what you would expect of me to show you when I said, we're going to show you how processes are created. You expect me to show you something that's this whole operation and not just fork. And you might say, why don't we just have a function that does all that? And well, that is a real choice that some OSs make. So Windows, for example, doesn't have something like fork. It has a create process function that's basically fork and exec combined. It makes a new process that's starting a new program from the beginning. And POSIX has a rarely used function that has the same idea called POSIX spawn. So why did the designers of Unix decide that fork was a good interface and they didn't have something that, like the create process interface that Windows has chosen? And the big advantage of the fork interface is that they didn't need to specify ways of setting a bunch of things about the newly created program that you might want to change. So for example, let's say I want to run a program but in a different directory than my current one. With fork and exec, I can do that by running a chdir here. And we already have a chdir call because we need to change directories normally. With the create process style interface, to support that, I need to add an additional argument to my create process call. And we can see this keep going. If I want to run a program but not have it output to the current terminal, there's all sorts of extra stuff we might have to have in this API. So the Unix people said, oh, we already have an API to change our current processes, working directory, and open files, and so on. We can just have fork let them use that API to configure the new program. So So that's probably why the designers of Unix chose the fork interface. And because we have a lot of OSs, notably Linux and OS X, that are in some way derived from the original Unix interface, we're kind of stuck with it. But there's clearly a disadvantage. This copy everything operation, not especially efficient. So maybe that's not something you really want to be doing, but the decision we made a while ago is that that's the interface Unix-like systems use. Now, to show you what a different interface would look like, I'll show you the example of POSIX Spawn, which is kind of a relatively recent interface POSIX came up with for doing these two operations, as one. So here's POSIX Spawn built running BinOS in the same way you saw with that fork and exec. So in this case, I pass the path and my argv, kind of like execv. And I have all these extra arguments because, as I mentioned, like kind of a nice thing about fork is that I can easily specify different things about the new process. Here, they had to have these arguments where I could pass data structures to specify things I want to change about the process, like new files I want open or different standard out, and other special settings I might want, has to be part of those arguments. So questions? And to say what people think, so here, as an example of some, if you want to see some reasoning about this, this is a paper from the 2019 workshop on Hot Topics in Operating Systems, which is the premier research venue for operating systems research papers that are also rants. And you can see here, they're ranting about fork being a clever hack for machines and programs of the 1970s that has long outlived its usefulness and is now a liability. So they're arguing that, if we could design clean slate, absolutely should not have an interface like fork. Probably not everyone agrees, but, why we have this fork and exec is largely because of the history when they were designing the original Unix, and everyone's just kept with that design. That's on fork and exec. So for our last few minutes, I'll talk about one missing piece we have with fork and exec. So here, after I run the program here, I have ls and my old program running at the same time, because that's what we saw fork does. After we call fork, both of the processes keep running. That's still going to be true here. But this makes it hard to implement something like what our shell does, where it waits for ls to finish before asking you the next thing to run. So how do we implement that waiting functionality? And POSIX provides us with wait PID for that. So here's our wait PID function. This is an example of that pattern I mentioned at the beginning of the semester, where this function really wants to return two values. So we return one value and pass a pointer into the other value to fill in. And in this case, our two values are the PID that was waited for, or -1 to indicate an error, and the exit status of the program. And we'll talk about what the status information is exactly in a bit. And the way this works is we pass in a PID, a place to put the exit status, and some options. For my examples, I'll use options of 0, meaning no options. You can look up in the man page what they are. Most notably, there's an option to not actually wait, just check if the process is already terminated. But we'll just always pass in 0 in my examples. And this PID here, as a special case, you can pass -1, meaning wait for any child process to finish, and that's why we have to return the PID. So if you use that mode, you want to know which child finished, you look at that return value. So our typical usage is we fork, and in the parent, we wait for the child, collect its exit status. In this example, I'm not doing anything with that, but we might want to do that. So something to note here is I have my parent process waiting for the child, and you have to do it that way. That here, I wrote down it waits for a child process, and it really means only a child process. Even if you know the PID of some other process, you can't wait for it with wait PID. Only wait for a child process, meaning one that you created with fork. So we have this status information. And what this should make you think of is that when you have written programs that exit, which probably you've done, in C at least, you return 0, or like call xset with an argument of 0, or 1, or something else. That 0, or whatever other number you put there, is called an xset status. And the primary thing that status value encodes is this information. But it actually has a little bit more. It's not quite the same, because it also tells us if the program didn't xset. So let's say the program segfaulted or got terminated by control C. In that case, this status variable will also encode that. So how do you decode it if it contains all this information? Well, the library provides you with these macros that start with a W to interpret that status value. So in this example, I determine if the program exited normally and what it passed to exit or return from main. Or if it didn't, I find out what signal resulted in it terminating. That might be like the segfault signal or the int signal for control C. And this is how something like a shell like tells you if the program segfaulted or just terminated normally. Okay, so next time we'll look at what the typical pattern of combining fork, exec, and wait looks like. And finish up our discussion of how respond processes happen.